Welcome, everybody. My name is Sherry Sellers, and this is Making the Change Talk. It's a podcast for people who are thinking about or on their journey towards a tobacco-free life. In this episode, we're going to look at the very real connection between tobacco use and mental health. And joining us today are two guests. We have Derek Nolan. He's community liaison at the Behavioral Health and Wellness Program at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. And also with us is Jim Pavlik. Jim is the Senior Program and Policy Analyst at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. Thank you both for being here, gentlemen. And I got to say, this is such an important and huge topic that honestly, it's hard to know where to start. Jim, can we begin with the fact that if you're living with mental health issues, you are more likely to use tobacco? Why?
So there could be a lot of reasons for that. One of the more important reasons is that the tobacco industry itself has scanned the landscape looking for those correlations with mental illness and has specifically geared its marketing and advertising to those individuals, specifically enticing them to treat nicotine or tobacco or smoking as a cure for their anxiety or for their depression, etc. There are also potentially some genetic and biological correlations as well, in that a lot of individuals create their dependence as a result of their socioeconomic or their familial conditions that they grew up in or that they work or live in. And then finally, there's self-treatment. So we know that nicotine is an anxiety reducing drug in the short term. We know that it is a stress reliever in the short term. We know that in the short term, it is a euphoriant that makes people feel good and might fight off some of the more negative consequences of, say, major depression. So all of those things combined lead to prevalence rates in the mental health population of about 3 to 4 times higher than what we would see in the general population.
And they're also smoking more cigarettes, correct?
It's a great point. Yeah, it's not just that we see higher prevalence rates in the behavioral health community, but we also see higher intensity and higher frequency smoking as well. Individuals with mental health conditions or behavioral health conditions are purchasing about 40% of all tobacco products, but they're purchasing about 44% of all actual cigarettes. So we're actually seeing more cigarettes consumed. And that, of course, is leading to higher incidence of early onset chronic diseases and, of course, premature mortality as well.
Derek, people think that this is helping. It's treating their mental illness. What's the reality? What, in the beginning, it may feel that way, but what's the truth?
The reality is that the trade-off for pursuing a very brief easing of symptoms, perhaps, or maybe a fleeting clarity of thought or focus, the trade-off is what Jim said. It is that great increase in the risk of early onset morbidity and ultimately death when people continue to use tobacco products.
I hear that, and I think how important it is that we educate. And there are so many different things that we need to touch on today. And one of those is that this is not just education for those who are smoking, but for the providers as well. What are you seeing on the provider side? What needs to be understood?
One of the biggest concerns on the provider level is that there's a lot of misinformation out there, and that definitely affects providers as well. Part of that is, as Jim mentioned, the work that the tobacco industry has done to spread misinformation to target people. That has an impact on the provider level as well. Sometimes, and this is not true in all cases, but sometimes in residential settings in particular, providers have operated historically under this misconception that if we allow people who are smoking to just have that cigarette, that we'll be able to focus on treating other conditions and that it will be somehow easier to treat other conditions. What we see in reality is really the opposite, where when cigarettes are present in treatment settings, it causes more chaos, more disorder, more conflict between the clients. If cigarettes are taken away, they're often more likely to leave against the advice of that doctor, that clinic. So a lot of problems that come from that.
And sadly, Jim, are there some clinics and even hospitals that unwittingly add to the problem by saying, let them have their cigarettes, they're working on something that's so much more difficult?
We would call that deprioritization. When some when a patient shows up at a treatment setting looking for some sort of you know, treatment or cure for whatever is ailing them, it could be that they've shown up for an acute emergency like a broken bone or an acute onset illness, something like a cold or a fever or pneumonia. It could be something chronic. They're seeing a rheumatologist, whatever the case may be. That provider is sort of chartered to respond to that condition immediately before moving on to other things. And that is just a condition of the profession. And, you know, we have some of the best trained and most caring doctors in the world. I have nothing but good things to say about our core of medical professionals. That being said, we do understand, and they also know, that tobacco use is the number one killer of Americans, and of course, of people worldwide. And they die routinely of chronic diseases. Somewhere between a third and a half of all individuals who use tobacco every day die from that. And again, our doctors know that. The problem is that it's not going to be the next cigarette that kills them. It's not going to be all the cigarettes they smoke this week that's going to kill them. It's the accumulation of all those cigarettes over a lifetime. And so we move from that acute care treatment. We move from the immediacy of whatever brought the person into a care facility to start with, and then moving into this sort of rehabituation. Can we give them new education and new habits so that they no longer have to rely on cigarettes for whatever purpose it serves for them? And that is just hard work. It's hard work for the provider, and it's hard work for the patient. The end result of that hard work is frequently relapse. Failure is likely, if not probable. It's still incumbent upon the doctor or the care provider to not make the assumption that the person in front of them can't quit, or that they can't quit for a specific reason. They can't quit because they're too stressed. They can't quit because of this other condition that we have to deal with first. The fact is that they're most likely to die from that tobacco use. And so it is incumbent upon the providers to provide the care that they are trained to provide.
There's this feeling that you can't quit, that it's stacked against you. So why try? What's the truth? Can these people successfully quit? Yeah, it's a lot of hard work, but can they do it?
Yes, the reality is that people can quit, and they can quit at very good rates. And whether or not we're talking about the general population or people with mental health conditions, we do see people quit every year. Moreover, people want to quit. Roughly two-thirds of people who smoke want to quit, and most of them try to quit every single year. One of the complications is that most of those quit attempts are not well thought out, and they're more off the cuff, the traditional cold turkey approach, if you will, where someone perhaps rather abruptly decides to try to quit in that moment. And what we know is that when people pursue more thoughtful quit attempts, where they're utilizing available counseling, and when they're utilizing available FDA-approved tobacco cessation medications, we see much greater quit results. Roughly, people who try to quit cold turkey, we see roughly 5% of those people succeeding in that quit attempt. And whereas when we are able to combine counseling with medication, we can see as high as 30% success rates.
Jim, I know there seems to be some confusion as well, that some people think that quitting is going to make their symptoms worse. Can you clear that up for us?
Quitting will absolutely not make your mental health symptoms worse. We know that people say that they use cigarettes as a stress reducer, and that is clearly and obviously the case. That's a top of the line survey response for the decades that we've been doing research in this category. The reality, however, is that all of the things that cigarettes deliver to the body, which is to say the stimulant that is nicotine, as well as all of those toxins, actually make stress worse. They give the illusion of alleviating stress, but that is largely because people are alleviating the symptoms of their own withdrawal. And the thing is, nicotine is unique compared to a lot of other drugs that people use recreationally or self-therapeutically like this, in that it actually has a bivalent response, which is to say that at certain conditions or certain doses, it can calm the nerves, quote unquote, calm the nerves. And at other doses, it will excite the nerves. So it can do both things. So people are actually using cigarettes to self-treat and improperly treat, let's say, a variety of conditions. And it's very hard for providers, people who want to intervene and help, to find all of the reasons that somebody is potentially smoking and why they are afraid to quit. But this becomes incumbent upon the provider to explore the tobacco use history with the client to make sure that we are replacing those benefits with more helpful alternatives.
Derek, does smoking have an impact on your mental health meds?
Smoking and the presence of cigarettes has a profound impact on medications of all kind, and particularly, yes, mental health medications as well. Also, even substances as common as caffeine are impacted by the presence of nicotine. When nicotine is present in the body, our metabolic function is sped up, and as a result, those medications are processed more quickly. And so what happens is that people need higher and higher dosages of that medication in order to get the desired effect from them, for instance, to treat mental health conditions. However, the big problem with that is that those medications come with a host of very significant side effects. And at higher dosage, those side effects are amplified, and it can make it harder to treat the mental health condition.
It's really easy to see how you can get into a negative space hearing all of this and get overwhelmed. Jim, what's the positive message you want to share? What can we say that gives hope?
I think that the message that I would want people to hear the most is that they absolutely can quit. First of all, we know that most tobacco users want to quit at any given time. About 75 to 80% of tobacco users say they want to make a quit attempt the next year. And about 65% of Americans make an attempt each year. And those are extremely high numbers. And that's very telling that people want to and that they try. The good news is that there is help available. And that is, there's help in terms of medicines that people can use. And those are 7 FDA-approved pharmacotherapy options, tobacco cessation medications. Those are 5 nicotine replacement therapy options and our 2 non-nicotine containing products, varenicline and bupropion. And there are counseling options, and those are counseling or coaching options, let's say. Individual counseling does wonders. Individual and group social support does wonders. And of course, we would be remiss if we did not mention the quit lines, which have incredibly high rates of success helping people quit.
Derek, is it possible that some people aren't reaching out just because the stigma of mental health holds them back?
Yes, that's definitely one of the reasons why people may be reluctant to reach out for help. There are many reasons. One of the significant ones is, for my money, a fear of failure. That fear of failure can be a real challenge where people, want to succeed. And when they think that that is unlikely, it's going to make it less likely that they attempt it. Looking at the big picture, though, what we see is that historically, 3 out of every 5 adults who have ever smoked in their lifetime have successfully been able to quit. And there are a lot of really exciting short and long-term benefits. People immediately start to, their blood pressure returns to the baseline. We see that breathing function and energy levels quickly return to normal. And as the years go on, the risk of diseases becomes lower and lower, often to the point where it basically is equal to someone who doesn't smoke or who has never smoked. Another thing that we see is that when people quit, their life expectancy goes up. For instance, someone who quits smoking at the age of 30 is likely to live about 10 years longer than their counterpart who at age 30 continues to smoke cigarettes. And as we always point out, it's not just that they're living longer, they're also living a much healthier life without the presence of smoking-related chronic diseases, without the stigma that we're describing associated with that, also without the cost of cigarettes and the sort of the dependency on that behavior, that habit, that really can be socially isolating and can increase stigma as well.
I'd love to ask both of you, because I know you travel the country together, right? Spreading the word, educating. Can you tell us about your passion? Derek, what drives your passion?
I became interested in tobacco cessation after first getting an opportunity to travel internationally and going into a lot of different countries, I became interested in public health at large and specifically chronic diseases. And I had a unique opportunity to do an internship in Prague, Czech Republic, where I got to work with Charles University in writing a tobacco manual for the medical students there, and also working with the Czech Republic Ministry of Health to look at the changing trends in histological types of lung cancer. And it was just fascinating to learn about the details about the impact of tobacco. And so having the opportunity to do this type of work, where not only do we work with organizations to help them implement change to positively impact the health of their clients, but also the opportunity that Jim and I have to travel nationally and to meet people who are, who have recovered from tobacco use, as well as all sorts of mental health and substance use disorders, and to see the passion that those people have for taking the lessons that they've learned and taking those health benefits that they enjoy and to providing that service to others who are on that journey. It's really inspirational to see that work, and we absolutely value the time that we get to spend face to face with those individuals.
Jim, how about you?
I really came at tobacco work from a much nerdier angle. I studied international relations at the graduate level and had a focus on international drug policy and sort of the unintended consequences of international drug policy, with a specific focus in my case on the Mexican drug war that was really prevalent while I was attending grad school. And I came into BHWP from that side, and recreational drug use and the policies surrounding which drugs are okay by legal standards, and which ones aren't, and which ones have stigmas and which ones don't, and where those stigmas come from. It's all very nerdy and very it's hard to even call that a passion necessarily, but that is in fact what I was passionate about at the time. But at the same time, I grew up in a military family, and then after my parents divorced, I grew up in a working class town in southern Indiana. Most of my friends and family at the time smoked, and as I've gotten older, I've seen a lot of those relatives pass away. I really am currently powered by those two things, both that sort of nerdy policy interest and then that sort of personal connection. One of the great things about working in public health is to wake up every morning knowing you're working for the good guys. And I think that that's 100% true. I feel good whenever anybody comes back to me and says, this is so great, it's going to help my practice so much, or even better, when somebody has told me that something I said or something I did or some policy that I helped implement helped somebody to actually quit smoking.
Tim, I know nationwide there's been for a long time a hesitancy to talk about mental health. Why is it important that we talk about mental health and tobacco use?
Visibility of anything that has been stigmatized is always really important. One of the sort of powerful weapons that the vice industries, that our drug industries, our tobacco industry, one of their more powerful weapons is to treat every single person as if they are 100% an individual. And America has a strong sense of powerful individualism that is fantastic, but it is a double-edged sword. When we feel like we are alone, then we start to suffer. We have to talk about the relationship between mental illness and drug dependence and recovery. We have to talk about these things out loud, because when we understand that we're in this struggle together, all of us, then we're far more likely to engage in that struggle and far more likely to succeed in it as well.
Derek, your thoughts on that topic, why it's so important that we do talk about this?
It's very true. And when we don't talk about this, we're really giving the tobacco industry free rein to operate. One of the things that we see is that the tobacco industry has excessive funds available to them to very specifically conduct those marketing campaigns that Jim described. They outspend public health about $18 to one in terms of the amount of funding that goes into either promoting tobacco use or fighting against tobacco use. And so the odds from a financial standpoint are against us. However, we have, as Jim mentioned, we're the good guys. We have the best health interests of the nation on our side. And so it's really important that we have this discussion so that people aren't operating in an isolated space.
Well, you are the good guys. And we thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us. We're just scratching the surface, right? There's so much to be learned, but thank you for joining us. And for those who are listening in, thank you as well. Be sure to listen to our next conversation on Making the Change Talk. Remember, and this is important, that the Quit Line is here for you 24/7. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or click on the Enroll Now link on the podcast homepage. Thank you, too.
Thank you. This has been fun.